Wood explained. Character formation began early, with family games of tossing naked children into the snow. They were pulled out quickly and placed next to the fire, in a practice reminiscent of Scandinavian saunas. When Indian boys came of age, they spent an entire winter alone in the forest, equipped only with a bow, a hatchet, and a knife. These methods worked, the odd Wood reported. Beat them, whip them, pinch them, punch them. If the Indians resolve not to flinch for it, they will not. Tisquantum's regimen was probably tougher than that of his friends, according to Salisbury, the Smith College historian. For it seems that he was selected to become a panice, a kind of counselor bodyguard to the sachem. To master the art of ignoring pain, future panice had to subject themselves to such miserable experiences as running bare-legged through brambles. And they fasted often to learn self-discipline. After spending their winter in the woods, panice candidates came back to an additional test, drinking bitter gentian juice until they vomited, repeating this bulimic process over and over until, near fainting, they threw up blood. Patuxet, like its neighboring settlements, was governed by a sachem, who upheld the law, negotiated treaties, controlled foreign contacts, collected tribute, declared war, provided for widows and orphans, and allocated farmland when there were disputes over it. Donlanders lived in a loose scatter, but they knew which family could use which land. Very exact and punctual, Roger Williams, founder of Rhode Island Colony, called Indian care for property lines. Most of the time, the Patuxet sachem owed fealty to the great sachem in the Wampanoag village to the southwest, and through him to the sachems of the allied confederations of the Nauset in Cape Cod and the Massachusetts around Boston. Meanwhile, the Wampanoag were rivals and enemies of the Narragansett and Pequots to the west and the many groups of Abenaki to the north. As a practical matter, sachems had to gain the consent of their people, who could easily move away and join another sachemship. Analogously, the great sachems had to please or bully the lesser, lest by the defection of small communities they lose stature. 16th century New England housed 100,000 people or more, a figure that was slowly increasing. Most of those people lived in shoreline communities, where rising numbers were beginning to change agriculture from an option to a necessity. These bigger settlements required more centralized administration. Natural resources like good land and spawning streams, though not scarce, now needed to be managed. In consequence, boundaries between groups were becoming more formal. Sachems, given more power and more to defend, pushed against each other harder. Political tensions were constant. Coastal and riverine New England, according to the archaeologist and ethnohistorian Peter Thomas, was an ever-changing collage of personalities, alliances, plots, raids, and encounters which involved every Indian settlement. Armed conflict was frequent but brief and mild by European standards. The casus belli was usually the desire to avenge an insult or gain status, not the wish for conquest. Most battles consisted of lightning guerrilla raids by ad hoc companies in the forest, flash of black and yellow striped bows behind trees, hiss and whip of stone-tipped arrows through the air, eruption of angry cries. Attackers slipped away as soon as retribution had been exacted. Losers quickly conceded their loss of status. Doing otherwise would have been like failing to resign after losing a major piece in a chess tournament, a social irritant, a waste of time and resources. Women and children were rarely killed, though they were sometimes abducted and forced to join the winning group. Captured men were often tortured. They were admired, though not necessarily spared, if they endured the pain stoically. Now and then, as a sign of victory, slain foes were scalped, much as British skirmishes with the Irish sometimes finished with a parade of Irish heads on pikes. In especially large clashes, adversaries might meet in the open, as in European battlefields, though the results, Roger Williams noted, were far less bloody and devouring than the cruel wars of Europe. Nevertheless, by Tisquantum's time, defensive palisades were increasingly common, especially in the river valleys. Inside the settlement was a world of warmth, family, and familiar custom, but the world outside, as Thomas put it, was a maze of confusing actions and individuals fighting to maintain an existence in the shadow of change. And that was before the Europeans showed up. Tourism and treachery. British fishing vessels may have reached Newfoundland as early as the 1480s, and areas to the south soon after. In 1501, just 9 years after Columbus's first voyage, the Portuguese adventurer Gaspar Corte-Real abducted 50-odd Indians from Maine. Examining the captives, Corte-Real found to his astonishment that two were wearing items from Venice: a broken sword and two silver rings. As James Axtell has noted, Corte-Real probably was able to kidnap such a large number of people only because the Indians were already so comfortable dealing with Europeans that big groups willingly came aboard his ship. The first Europeans known to have reached the Americas were the Vikings, who appeared off eastern Canada in the 10th century. Their short-lived venture had no known effect on native life. Other European groups may also have arrived before Columbus, but they too had no well-substantiated impact on the people they visited. The earliest written description of the people of the First Light was by Giovanni da Verrazzano, an Italian mariner for hire commissioned by the King of France in 1523 to discover whether one could reach Asia by rounding the Americas to the north. Sailing north from the Carolinas, he observed that the coastline everywhere was densely populated, smoky with Indian bonfires. He could sometimes smell the burning hundreds of miles away. The ship anchored in wide Narragansett Bay, near what is now Providence, Rhode Island. Verrazzano was one of the first Europeans the natives had seen, perhaps even the first. But the Narragansett were not intimidated. Almost instantly, 20 long canoes surrounded the visitors. Cocksure and graceful, the Narragansett sachem leapt aboard, a tall, long-haired man of about 40, with multicolored jewelry dangling about his neck and ears. "As beautiful of stature and build as I can possibly describe," Verrazzano wrote. His reaction was common. Time and time again, Europeans described the people of the First Light as strikingly healthy specimens, eating an incredibly nutritious diet. Working hard but not broken by toil, the people of New England were taller and more robust than those who wanted to move in. "As proper men and women for feature and limbs as can be found," in the words of the rebellious pilgrim Thomas Morton. Because famine and epidemic disease had been rare in the Dawnland, its inhabitants had none of the pox scars or rickety limbs common on the other side of the Atlantic. Native New Englanders, in William Wood's view, were "more amiable to behold, though dressed only in Adam's finery, than many a compounded fantastic English dandy in the newest fashion." The pilgrims were less sanguine about Indians' multicolored, multi-textured mode of self-presentation. To be sure, the newcomers accepted the practicality of deerskin robes as opposed to, say, fitted British suits. And the colonists understood why native skin and hair shone with bear or eagle fat. It warded off sun, wind, and insects. And they could overlook the Indians' practice of letting prepubescent children run about without a stitch on. But the pilgrims, who regarded personal adornment as a species of idolatry, were dismayed by what they saw as the indigenous penchant for foppery. The robes were adorned with animal head mantles, snakeskin belts, and bird-wing headdresses. Worse, many Dawnlanders tattooed their faces, arms, and legs with elaborate geometric patterns and totemic animal symbols. They wore jewelry made of shell and swan's down earrings and chignons spiked with eagle feathers. If that weren't enough, both sexes painted their faces red, white, and black, ending up, Gookin sniffed, with one part of their face of one color and another of another very deformedly. And the hair. As a rule, young men wore it long on one side, in an equine mane, but cropped the other side short, which prevented it from getting tangled in their bowstrings. But sometimes they cut their hair into such wild patterns that attempting to imitate them, Wood sniffed, would torture the wits of a curious barber. Tonsures, pigtails, head completely shaved but for a single forelock, long sides drawn into a queue with a raffish short-cut roach in the middle. All of it was prideful and abhorrent to the pilgrims. Not everyone in England saw it that way. Inspired by asymmetrical Indian coiffures, 17th century London blades wore long, loose hanks of hair known as lovelocks. The imitation was entirely appropriate. Much as European gentlemen took care to announce themselves in wigs and flamboyantly colored silk suits, Indian blades wore their hair in tattoos to proclaim their status as men of import and style. As for the Indians, evidence suggests that they tended to view Europeans with disdain as soon as they got to know them. The Wendat, Huron, in Ontario, a chagrined missionary reported, thought the French possessed little intelligence in comparison to themselves. Europeans, Indians told other Indians, were physically weak, sexually untrustworthy, atrociously ugly, and just plain smelly. The British and French, many of whom had not taken a bath in their entire lives, were amazed by the Indian interest in personal cleanliness. A Jesuit reported that the savages were disgusted by handkerchiefs. They say we place what is unclean in a fine white piece of linen and put it away in our pockets as something very precious, while they throw it upon the ground. The Mi'kmaq in New Brunswick in Nova Scotia scoffed at the notion of European superiority. If Christian civilization was so wonderful, why were its inhabitants all trying to settle somewhere else? For 15 days, Verrazano and his crew were the Narragansett's honored guests. Though the Indians, Verrazano admitted, kept their women out of sight after hearing the sailors' irksome clamor when females came into view. Much of the time was spent in friendly barter. To the Europeans' confusion, their steel and cloth did not interest the Narragansett, who wanted to swap only for little bells, blue crystals, and other trinkets to put in the ear or around the neck. On Verrazano's next stop, the Maine coast, the Abenaki did want steel and cloth, demanded them, in fact. But up north, the friendly welcome had vanished. The Indians denied the visitors permission to land, refusing even to touch the Europeans. They passed goods back and forth on a rope over the water. As soon as the crew members sent over the last items, the locals began showing their buttocks and laughing, mooned by the Indians. Verrazano was baffled by this barbarous behavior. But the reason for it seems clear. Unlike the Narragansett, the Abenaki had long experience with Europeans. During the century after Verrazano, Europeans were regular visitors to the Dawn Land, usually fishing, sometimes trading, occasionally kidnapping natives as souvenirs. Verrazano had grabbed one himself, a boy of about 8. By 1610, Britain alone had about 200 vessels operating off Newfoundland and New England. Hundreds more came from France, Spain, Portugal, and Italy. With striking uniformity, these travelers reported that New England was thickly settled and well defended. In 1605 and 1606, Samuel de Champlain, the famous explorer, visited Cape Cod, hoping to establish a French base. He abandoned the idea. Too many people already lived there. A year later, Sir Fernando Gorges, British, despite the name, tried to found a community in Maine. It began with more people than the Pilgrims' later venture in Plymouth, and was better organized and supplied. Nonetheless, the local Indians, numerous and well-armed, killed 11 colonists and drove the rest back home within months. Many ships anchored off Patuxent. Martin Pring, a British trader, camped there with a crew of 44 for 7 weeks in the summer of 1603, gathering sassafras. The species was common in the cleared, burned-over areas at the edge of Indian settlements. To ingratiate themselves with their hosts, Pring's crew regularly played the guitar for them. The Indians had drums, flutes, and rattles, but no string instruments. Despite the entertainment, the Patuxent eventually got tired of the foreigners camping out on their land. Giving their guests a subtle hint that they should be moving on, 140 armed locals surrounded their encampment. Next day, the Patuxent burned down the woodlands where Pring and his men were working. The foreigners left within hours. Some 200 Indians watched them from the shore, politely inviting them to come back for another short visit. Later, Champlain too stopped at Patuxent, but left before wearing out his welcome. Tisquantum probably saw Pring, Champlain, and other European visitors. But the first time Europeans are known to have affected his life was in the summer of 1614. A small ship hove to, sails a flap. Out to meet the crew came the Patuxent. Almost certainly the sachem would have been of the party. He would have been accompanied by his pinnace, including Tisquantum. The stranger's leader was a sight beyond belief, a stocky man, even shorter than most foreigners, with a voluminous red beard that covered so much of his face that he looked to Indian eyes more beast than human. This was Captain John Smith of Pocahontas fame. According to Smith, he had lived an adventurous and glamorous life. As a youth, he claimed, he had served as a privateer, after which he was captured and enslaved by the Turks. He escaped and awarded himself the rank of captain in the army of Smith. Later, he actually became captain of a ship and traveled to North America several times. On this occasion, he had sailed to Maine with two ships, intending to hunt whales. The party spent 2 months chasing the beasts, but failed to catch a single one. Plan B, Smith wrote later, was fish and furs. He assigned most of the crew to catch and dry fish in one ship, while he puttered up and down the coast with the other, bartering for furs. In the middle of this perambulating, he showed up in Patuxent. Despite Smith's peculiar appearance, Tisquantum and his fellows treated him well. They apparently gave him a tour, during which he admired the gardens, orchards, and maize fields, and the great troops of well-proportioned people tending them. At some point, a quarrel occurred and bows were drawn, Smith said. 40 or 50 Patuxent surrounding him. His account is vague, but one imagines the Indians were hinting at a limit to his stay. In any case, the visit ended cordially enough, and Smith returned to Maine and then England. He had a map drawn of what he had seen, persuaded Prince Charles to look at it, and curried favor with him by asking him to award British names to all the Indian settlements. Then he put the maps in the books he wrote to extol his adventures. In this way, Patuxent acquired its English name, Plymouth, after the city in England. It was then spelled P-L-I-M-O-T-H. Smith left his lieutenant, Thomas Hunt, behind in Maine to finish loading the other ship with dried fish. Without consulting Smith, Hunt decided to visit Patuxent. Taking advantage of the Indians' recent good experience with English visitors, he invited people to come aboard. The thought of a summer day on the foreigner's vessel must have been tempting. Several dozen villagers, Tisquantum among them, canoed to the ship. Without warning or pretext, the sailors tried to shove them into the hold. The Indians fought back. Hunt's men swept the deck with small arms fire, creating a great slaughter. At gunpoint, Hunt forced the survivors below decks. With Tisquantum and at least 19 others, he sailed to Europe, stopping only once at Cape Cod, where he kidnapped 7 Nauset. In Hunt's wake, the Patuxent community raged, as did the rest of the Wampanoag Confederacy and the Nauset. The sachems vowed not to let foreigners rest on their shores again. Because of the worthless hunt, lamented Georges, the would-be colonizer of Maine. A war was now new begun between the inhabitants of those parts and us. Despite European guns, the Indians' greater numbers, entrenched positions, knowledge of the terrain, and superb archery made them formidable adversaries. About 2 years after Hunt's offenses, a French ship wrecked at the tip of Cape Cod. Its crew built a rude shelter with a defensive wall made from poles. The Nauset, hidden outside, picked off the sailors one by one until only five were left. They captured the five and sent them to groups victimized by European kidnappers. Another French vessel anchored in Boston Harbor at about the same time. The Massachusetts killed everyone aboard and set the ship afire. Tisquantum was away 5 years. When he returned, everything had changed, calamitously. Patuxet had vanished. The pilgrims had literally built their village on top of it. The Place of the Skull. According to family lore, my great-grandmother's great-grandmother's great-grandfather was the first European person hanged in North America. His name was John Billington. He emigrated aboard the Mayflower, which anchored off the coast of Massachusetts on November 9, 1620. Billington was not among the company of saints, to put it mildly. Within 6 months of arrival, he became the first European in America to be tried for sassing the police. His two sons were no better. Even before landing, one nearly blew up the Mayflower by shooting a gun at a keg of gunpowder while inside the ship. After the pilgrims landed, the other son ran off to live with some nearby Indians, leading to great consternation and an expedition to fetch him back. Meanwhile, Billington Pear made merry with other non-Puritan lowlifes and haphazardly plotted against authority. The family was one of the profanest in Plymouth Colony, complained William Bradford, its long-serving governor. Billington, in his opinion, was a knave and so shall live and die. What one historian called Billington's troublesome career ended in 1630 when he was hanged for shooting somebody in a quarrel. My family has always claimed that he was framed. But we would say that, wouldn't we? Growing up, I was always tickled by this raffish personal connection to history. Part of the Puritans, but not actually puritanical. As an adult, I decided to learn more about Billington. A few hours at the library sufficed to convince me that some aspects of our agreeable family legend were untrue. Although Billington was in fact hanged, at least two other Europeans were executed in North America before him, and one of them was convicted for the much more interesting offense of killing his pregnant wife and eating her. My ancestor was probably only number three, and there is a whisper of scholarly doubt about whether he deserves to be even that high on the list. I had learned about Plymouth in school, but it was not until I was poking through the scattered references to Billington that it occurred to me that my ancestor, like everyone else in the colony, had voluntarily enlisted in a venture that had him arriving in New England without food or shelter 6 weeks before winter. Not only that, he joined a group that, so far as it is known, set off with little idea of where it was heading. In Europe, the pilgrims had refused to hire the experienced John Smith as a guide, on the theory that they could use the maps in his book. In consequence, as Smith later crowed, the hapless Mayflower spent several frigid weeks scouting around Cape Cod for a good place to land, during which time many colonists became sick and died. Landfall at Patuxet did not end their problems. The colonists had intended to produce their own food, but inexplicably neglected to bring any cows, sheep, mules, or horses. To be sure, the pilgrims had intended to make most of their livelihood not by farming, but by catching fish for export to Britain. But the only fishing gear the pilgrims brought was useless in New England. Half of the 102 people on the Mayflower made it through the first winter, which to me seemed amazing. How did they survive? In his history of Plymouth Colony, Governor Bradford himself provides one answer: robbing Indian houses and graves. The Mayflower hove to first at Cape Cod. An armed company of pilgrims staggered out. Eventually, they found a deserted Indian habitation. The newcomers, hungry, cold, sick, dug open burial sites and ransacked homes, looking for underground stashes of food. After 2 days of nervous work, the company hauled 10 bushels of maize back to the Mayflower, carrying much of the booty in a big metal kettle the men had also stolen. "And sure, it was God's good providence that we found this corn," Winslow wrote, "for else we know not how we should have done." The pilgrims were typical in their lack of preparation. Expeditions from France and Spain were usually backed by the state, and generally staffed by soldiers accustomed to hard living. English voyages, by contrast, were almost always funded by venture capitalists who hoped for a quick cash out. Like Silicon Valley in the heyday of the internet bubble, London was the center of a speculative mania about the Americas. As with the dot-com boom, a great deal of profoundly fractured cerebration occurred. Decades after first touching the Americas, London's venture capitalists still hadn't figured out that New England is colder than Britain, despite being farther south. Even when they focused on a warmer place like Virginia, they persistently selected as colonists people ignorant of farming. Multiplying the difficulties, the would-be colonizers were arriving in the middle of a severe, multi-year drought. As a result, Jamestown and the other Virginia forays survived on Indian charity. They were utterly dependent and therefore controllable, in the phrase of Karen Ordahl Kupperman, a New York University historian. The same held true for my ancestors' crew in Plymouth. Inexperienced in agriculture, the pilgrims were also not woods people. Indeed, they were so incurious about their environment that Bradford felt obliged to comment in his journal when Francis Billington, my ancestor's son, climbed to the top of a tall tree to look around. As Thoreau noted with disgust, the colonists landed at Plymouth on December 16th, but it was not until January 8th that one of them went as far away as 2 miles. And even then, the traveler was, again, Francis Billington. "A party of emigrants to California or Oregon," Thoreau complained, "with no less work on their hands and more hostile Indians, would do as much exploring in the first afternoon, and the Sieur de Champlain would have sought an interview with the savages and examined the country as far as the Connecticut River, 80 miles away, and made a map of it before Billington had climbed his tree." Huddled in their half-built village that first terrible winter, the colonists rarely saw the area's inhabitants, except for the occasional shower of copper or claw-tipped arrows. After February, glimpses and sightings became more frequent. Scared, the pilgrims hauled 5 small cannons from the Mayflower and emplaced them in a defensive fortification. But after all the anxiety, their first contact with the Indians went surprisingly easily. Within days, Tisquantum came to settle among them, and then they heard his stories. No record survives of Tisquantum's first journey across the Atlantic, but arithmetic gives some hint of the conditions in Hunt's ship. John Smith had arrived with 2 ships and a crew of 45. If the 2 ships had been of equal size, Hunt would have sailed with a crew of about 22. Because Hunt, Smith's subordinate, had the smaller of the 2 vessels, the actual number was surely less. Adding 20 or more captured Indians thus meant that the ship was sailing with at least twice its normal complement. Tisquantum would have been tied or chained to prevent rebellion, and jammed into whatever dark corner of the hull was available. Presumably, he was fed from the ship's cargo of dried fish. Smith took 6 weeks to cross the Atlantic to England. There is no reason to think Hunt went faster. The only difference was that he took his ship to Malaga, on Spain's Mediterranean coast. There he intended to sell all of his cargo, including the human beings. The Indians' appearance in this European city surely caused a stir. Not long before, Shakespeare had griped in The Tempest that the populace of the much bigger city of London would not give a doit, a small coin, to a lame beggar, but will lay out 10 to see a dead Indian. Hunt managed to sell only a few of his captives before local Roman Catholic priests seized the rest. The Spanish Church vehemently opposed brutality toward Indians. In 1537, Pope Paul III proclaimed that Indians themselves indeed are true men and should not be deprived of their liberty and reduced to our service like brute animals. The priests intended to save both Tisquantum's body by preventing his enslavement and his soul by converting him to Christianity. It is unlikely that Tisquantum was converted, though it's possible that he allowed the friars to think he had been. In any case, this resourceful man convinced them to let him return home, or rather, to try to return. He got to London, where he stayed with John Slaney, a shipbuilder with investments in Newfoundland. Slaney apparently taught Tisquantum English while maintaining him as a curiosity in his townhouse. Meanwhile, Tisquantum persuaded him to arrange for passage to North America on a fishing vessel. He ended up in a tiny British fishing camp on the southern edge of Newfoundland. It was on the same continent as Patuxet, but between them were 1,000 miles of rocky coastline and the Mi'kmaq and Abenaki alliances, which were at war with one another. Because traversing this unfriendly territory would be difficult, Tisquantum began looking for a ride to Patuxet. He extolled the bounty of New England to Thomas Dermer, one of Smith's subordinates, who was then staying in the same camp. Dermer, excited by Tisquantum's promise of easy wealth, contacted Ferdinando Gorges. Gorges, a longtime, slightly dotty enthusiast about the Americas, promised to send over a ship with the men, supplies, and legal papers necessary for Dermer to take a crack at establishing a colony in New England. Dermer, with Tisquantum, was supposed to meet the ship when it arrived in New England. One Edward Rowcraft captained the ship sent by Gorges from England. According to Gorges' principal biographer, Rowcraft appears to have been unfit for such an enterprise. This was an understatement. In a bizarre episode, Rowcraft sailed to the main coast in early 1619, promptly spotted a French fishing boat, seized it for supposedly trespassing on British property, North America, placed its crew in chains aboard his own ship, sent that ship back to Gorges with the prisoners, continued his journey on the smaller French vessel, which led to a mutiny, quelled the mutiny, stranded the mutineers on the main coast, discovered that A, without the mutineers, he didn't have enough people to operate the captured ship, and B, it was slowly filling up with water from leaks, and decided to sail immediately for Britain's colony in Jamestown, Virginia, which had the facilities to repair the hull, a course that entailed skipping the promised rendezvous with Dermer. At Jamestown, Rowcraft managed, through inattentiveness, to sink his ship. Not long afterward, he was killed in a brawl. Incredibably, Dermer failed to execute his part of the plan, too. In orthodox comedy of error style, he did not wait for Rowcraft in Maine, as he was supposed to, but sailed back to England, to Tisquantum in tow. The two ships more or less cross paths in the Atlantic. Dermer and Tisquantum met personally with Gorges. Gorges may have met Tisquantum before. In 1605, the adventurer George Weymouth abducted 5 Indians, conning 3 into boarding his ship voluntarily and seizing the other 2 by the hair. According to Gorges's memoirs, Tisquantum was one of the 5. He stayed with Gorges for 9 years. After which he went to New England with John Smith. If this is correct, Tisquantum had barely come home before being kidnapped again. Historians tend to discount Gorges' tale, partly because his memoirs, dictated late in life, mix up details, and partly because the notion that Tisquantum was abducted twice just seems incredible. Evidently, they made an excellent impression. For despite Dermer's proven inability to follow instructions, Gorges sent him back with Tisquantum and a fresh ship to meet Rowcraft, who was supposed to be waiting for them in New England. Dermer touched land in Maine and discovered that Rowcraft had already left. On May 19, 1619, still accompanied by Tisquantum, he set out for Massachusetts, hoping to catch up with Rowcraft. He didn't know that Rowcraft had sunk his own ship. What Tisquantum saw on his return home was unimaginable. From southern Maine to Narragansett Bay, the coast was empty, utterly void, Dermer reported. What had once been a line of busy communities was now a mass of tumble-down homes and untended fields overrun by blackberries. Scattered among the houses and fields were skeletons bleached by the sun. Slowly, Dermer's crew realized they were sailing along the border of a cemetery 200 miles long and 40 miles deep. Patuxet had been hit with special force. Not a single person remained. Tisquantum's entire social world had vanished. Looking for his kinfolk, he led Dermer on a melancholy march inland. The settlements they passed lay empty to the sky, but full of untended dead. Tisquantum's party finally encountered some survivors, a handful of families in a shattered village. These people sent for Massasoit, who appeared, Dermer wrote, with a guard of 50 armed men and a captive French sailor, a survivor of the shipwreck on Cape Cod. Massasoit asked Dermer to send back the Frenchmen, and then he told Tisquantum what had happened. One of the French sailors had learned enough Massachusetts to inform his captors before dying that God would destroy them for their misdeeds. The Nauset scoffed at the threat. But the Europeans carried a disease, and they bequeathed it to their jailers. Based on accounts of the symptoms, the epidemic was probably a viral hepatitis, according to a study by Arthur E. Spies of the Maine Historic Preservation Commission, and Bruce D. Spies of the Medical College of Virginia. In their view, the strain was, like hepatitis A, probably spread by contaminated food, rather than by sexual contact, like hepatitis B or C. Whatever the cause, the results were ruinous. The Indians died in heaps as they lay in their houses, the merchant Thomas Morton observed. In their panic, the healthy fled from the sick, carrying the disease with them to neighboring communities. Behind them remained the dying, left for crows, kites, and vermin to prey upon. Beginning in 1616, the pestilence took at least 3 years to exhaust itself and killed as much as 90% of the people in coastal New England. And the bones and skulls upon the several places of their habitations made such a spectacle, Morton wrote, that the Massachusetts woodlands seemed to be a newfound Golgotha, the place of the skull, where executions took place in Roman Jerusalem. The religious overtones in Morton's metaphor are well placed. Neither the Indians nor the Pilgrims had our contemporary understanding of infectious disease. Each believed that sickness reflected the will of celestial forces. As the writer and historian Paula Gunn Allen put it, the idea that the realm of the spirits or the supernatural was powerfully engaged in the day-to-day life of nations, as well as of villagers, was commonly held on both sides of the Atlantic. Both, Indians and Europeans, predicted events by the position of certain stars on the ecliptic plane around Earth, as much as by visionary techniques, and both assumed the reality of malicious as well as beneficent supernaturals. The only real question in the minds of either side was whether Indian spiritual forces could affect Europeans, and vice versa. As an experiment, Cotton Mather, a celebrated New England minister, tried to exorcise the demons in a possessed young woman with incantations in Massachusetts. To his satisfaction, the results demonstrated empirically that Indian magic had no effect on Christian devils. Until the sickness, Massasoit had directly ruled a community of several thousand and held sway over a confederation of as many as 20,000. Now his group was reduced to 60 people and the entire confederation to fewer than 1,000. The Wampanoag, wrote Salisbury, the Smith historian, came to the obvious logical conclusion. Their deities had allied against them. The Pilgrims held similar views. Governor Bradford is said to have attributed the plague to the good hand of God, which favored our beginnings, by sweeping away great multitudes of the natives, that he might make room for us. Indeed, more than 50 of the first colonial villages in New England were located on Indian communities emptied by disease. The epidemic, Gorgias said, left the land without any people to disturb or appease our free and peaceable possession thereof, from when we may justly conclude that God made the way to effect his work. Much as the Lisbon earthquake of 1755, which killed tens of thousands in one of Europe's richest cities, prompted spiritual malaise across Europe, the New England epidemic shattered the Wampanoag's sense that they lived in balance with an intelligible world. On top of that, the massive death toll created a political crisis. Because the hostility between the Wampanoag and the neighboring Narragansett had restricted contact between them, the disease had not spread to the latter. Massasoit's people were not only beset by loss, they were in danger of subjugation. After learning about the epidemic, the distraught Tisquantum first returned with Dermer to southern Maine. Apparently concluding he was never going to meet Rowcraft, Dermer decided in 1620 to make another pass at New England. Tisquantum returned too, but not with Dermer. Instead, he walked home, the long, risky journey he had wanted to avoid. In the interim, yet another English expedition had attacked the Wampanoag, killing several without apparent provocation. Understandably enraged, Indians attacked Dermer several times on his journey south. He was eventually slain on Martha's Vineyard by another former Indian abductee. For his part, Tisquantum was seized on his journey home, perhaps because of his association with the hated English, and sent to Massasoit as a captive. As he had before, Tisquantum talked his way out of a jam. This time he extolled the English, filling Massasoit's ears with tales of their cities, their great numbers, their powerful technology. Tisquantum said, according to a colonist who knew him, that if the sachem could make the English his friends, then any enemies that were too strong for him, in other words, the Narragansett, would be constrained to bow to him. The sachem listened without trust. Within a few months, word came that a party of English had set up shop at Patuxet. The Wampanoag observed them suffer through the first punishing winter. Eventually, Massasoit concluded that he possibly should ally with them. Compared to the Narragansett, they were the lesser of two evils. Still, only when the need for a translator became unavoidable did he allow Tisquantum to meet the pilgrims. Massasoit had considerable experience with Europeans. His father had sent Martin Pring on his way 17 years before. But that was before the epidemic, when Massasoit had the option of expelling them. Now he told the pilgrims that he was willing to leave them in peace, a bluff, one assumes, since driving them away would have taxed his limited resources. But in return, he wanted the colonists' assistance with the Narragansett. To the pilgrims, the Indians' motives for the deal were obvious. They wanted European technology on their side. In particular, they wanted guns. "He thinks we may be of some strength to him," Winslow said later, "for our pieces, guns, are terrible to them." In fact, Massasoit had a subtler plan. It is true that European technology dazzled Native Americans on first encounter, but the relative positions of the two sides were closer than commonly believed. Contemporary research suggests that indigenous peoples in New England were not technologically inferior to the British. Or rather, that terms like superior and inferior do not readily apply to the relationship between Indian and European technology. Guns are an example. As Chaplin, the Harvard historian, has argued, New England Indians were indeed disconcerted by their first experiences with European guns. The explosion and smoke, the lack of a visible projectile. But the natives soon learned that most of the British were terrible shots, from lack of practice. Their guns were little more than noisemakers. Even for a crack shot, an unrifled, early 17th century gun had fewer advantages over a longbow than may be supposed. Colonists in Jamestown taunted the Powhatan in 1607 with a target they believed impervious to an arrow shot. To the colonists' dismay, an Indian sank an arrow into it a foot deep, which was strange, being that a pistol could not pierce it. To regain the upper hand, the English set up a target made of steel. This time, the archer burst his arrow all to pieces. The Indian was in a great rage. He realized, one assumes, that the foreigners had cheated. When the Powhatan later captured John Smith, Chaplin notes, Smith broke his pistol rather than reveal to his captors the awful truth that it could not shoot as far as an arrow could fly. At the same time, Europeans were impressed by American technology. The foreigners, coming from a land plagued by famine, were awed by maize, which yields more grain per acre than any other cereal. Indian moccasins were so much more comfortable and waterproof than stiff, moldering English boots, that when colonists had to walk for long distances, their Indian companions often pitied their discomfort and gave them new footwear. Indian birchbark canoes were faster and more maneuverable than any small European boat. In 1605, three laughing Indians in a canoe literally paddled circles round the lumbering dory rowed by traveler George Weymouth and seven other men. Despite official disapproval, the stunned British eagerly exchanged knives and guns for Indian canoes. Bigger European ships with sails had some advantages. Indians got hold of them through trade and shipwreck, and trained themselves to be excellent sailors. By the time of the epidemic, a rising proportion of the shipping traffic along the New England coast was of indigenous origin. Reading Massasoit's motives at this distance is a chancy business. But it seems likely that he did not want to ally with the foreigners primarily for their guns, as they believed. Although the sachem doubtless relished the prestige of foreign firepower, he probably wanted more to confront the Narragansett with the unappetizing prospect of attacking one group of English people at the same time that their main trading partners were other English people. Faced with the possibility of disrupting their favored position as middlemen, the Narragansett might think twice before staging an incursion. Massasoit, if this interpretation is correct, was trying to incorporate the Pilgrims into the web of native politics. Not long before, Massasoit had expelled foreigners who stayed too long in Wampanoag territory. But with the entire Confederation now smaller than one of its former communities, the best option seemed to be allowing the Pilgrims to remain. It was a drastic, even fatal, decision. Machinations. Tisquantum worked to prove his value to the Pilgrims. He was so successful that when some anti-British Indians abducted him, the colonists sent out a military expedition to get him back. They did not stop to ask themselves why he might be making himself essential, given how difficult it must have been to live in the ghost of his childhood home. In retrospect, the answer seems clear. The alternative to staying in Plymouth was returning to Massasoit and renewed captivity. Recognizing that the Pilgrims would be unlikely to keep him around forever, Tisquantum decided to gather together the few survivors of Patuxet and reconstitute the old community at a site near Plymouth. More ambitious still, he hoped to use his influence on the English to make this new Patuxet the center of the Wampanoag Confederation, thereby stripping the sachemship from Massasoit, who had held him captive. To accomplish these goals, he intended to play the Indians and English against each other. The scheme was risky, not least because the ever-suspicious Massasoit sent one of his pinnies, Hobomok, to Plymouth as a monitor. Hobomok, like Tisquantum, apparently adopted a new name in his dealings with the British. Hobomok was the source of evil in Wampanoag cosmology. Sometimes the two men were able to work together, as when Hobomok and Tisquantum helped the Pilgrims negotiate a treaty with the Massachusetts to the north. They also helped establish a truce with the Nauset of Cape Cod after Brantford promised to pay back the losses caused by their earlier grave robbing. By fall, The settlers' situation was secure enough that they held a feast of Thanksgiving. Massasoit showed up with 90 people, most of them young men with weapons. The Pilgrim militia responded by marching around and firing their guns in the air in a manner intended to convey menace. Gratified, both sides sat down, ate a lot of food, and complained about the Narragansett. Eka, Thanksgiving. All the while, Tisquantum covertly tried to persuade other Wampanoag that he was better able to protect them against the Narragansett than Massasoit. In case of attack, Tisquantum claimed, he could respond with an equal number of Indian troops and the Pilgrims, who might be able to intimidate the enemy. He evidently believed that the Narragansett did not have enough experience with European guns to know that they were not as fearsome as they first appeared. To advance his case, Tisquantum told other Indians that the foreigners had hidden away casefuls of the agent that caused the epidemic, and that he could manipulate them into unleashing it. Even as Tisquantum attempted to foment Indian distrust of Massasoit, he told the colonists that Massasoit was going to double-cross them by leading a joint attack on Plymouth with the Narragansett. And he attempted to trick the Pilgrims into attacking the Sachem. In the spring of 1622, Tisquantum accompanied a delegation to the Massachusetts in Boston Harbor. Minutes after they left, Bradford later recalled, one of the surviving Patuxet came running in seeming great fear to inform the settlers that the Narragansett, and he thought also Massasoit, were planning to attack. The idea clearly was that the colonists, enraged by the putative assault, would rise up and smite Massasoit. Tisquantum would be away, so his hands would seem clean. Instead, everything went awry. In Indian villages, people could only be summoned by shouting. Once a canoe had gone a few hundred yards, it could not readily be called back. But when the news came of the impending attack, Bradford ordered the Pilgrims to fire a cannon to order back the expedition and Tisquantum. Meanwhile, Hobomok, who had acquired some English, indignantly denied the story. In a move that Tisquantum apparently had not anticipated, Bradford dispatched Hobomok's wife to Massasoit's home to find out what the Sachem was doing. She reported that all was quiet. Actually, this wasn't entirely true. Massasoit was furious at Tisquantum. He demanded that the Pilgrims send their translator to him for a quick execution. Bradford refused. Tisquantum's language skills were too vital. "Tisquantum is one of my subjects," Massasoit said. "You Pilgrims have no jurisdiction over him." And he offered a cache of fur to sweeten the deal. When the colony still would not surrender to Tisquantum, Massasoit sent a messenger with a knife and told Bradford to lop off Tisquantum's hands and head. To make his displeasure manifest, he summoned Hobomok home and cut off contact with the Pilgrims. Nervous, the colonists began building defensive fortifications. Worse, almost no rain fell between mid-May and mid-July, withering their crops. Because the Wampanoag had stopped trading with them, the Pilgrims would not be able to supplement their harvest. Tisquantum, afraid of Massasoit's wrath, was unable to take a step outside of Plymouth without an escort. Nonetheless, he accompanied Bradford on a trip to southeast Cape Cod to negotiate another pact. They were on the way home when Tisquantum suddenly became sick. He died in a few days, his hopes in ruins. In the next decade, tens of thousands of Europeans came to Massachusetts. Massasoit shepherded his people through the wave of settlement, and the pact he signed with Plymouth lasted for more than 50 years. Only in 1675 did one of his sons, angered at being pushed around by colonist laws, launch what was perhaps an inevitable attack. Indians from many other groups joined in. The conflict, brutal and sad, tore through New England. The Europeans won. Indeed, after the war, Massachusetts sold more than 1,000 Indians into slavery, perhaps one out of every 10 native adults in the region. Most went to the Caribbean, but a few ended up as far away as North Africa. Their treatment, alas, was not exceptional. The English sailors who kidnapped and sold to Squantum had been succeeded by English colonists who were willing to do the same, especially if the Indians involved had done something viewed as criminal. Fought against colonization, for example. Some English criminals were also sold into slavery under the same theory. By the eve of the American Revolution, a third of the native people in Rhode Island were enslaved. Indian bondage was more common still in the southern colonies. The historian Alan Gillay has estimated that between 1670 and 1715, English slavers in the south sold somewhere between 30 and 50,000 native people. So many were exported to New England that most colonies there tried to ban or restrict the trade. The southern Indians were regarded as troublemakers. To be sure, Indians were not entirely hapless victims. Most slaves were prisoners of war, seized in intertribal conflicts and sold by enemy Indian groups to the English in exchange for guns, pots, and axes. Nonetheless, the simple existence of the Indian slave trade, thousands of native men and women working in bondage for Europeans, was a testament to Indians' catastrophic loss of power and status. What happened? Europeans won military victories in New England, historians say, partly because they were divided among themselves. Indians were unwilling, too, to match the English tactic of massacring whole villages. But another, bigger part of the reason for the foreigners' triumph was that by the 1670s, the newcomers outnumbered the natives. Groups like the Narragansett, which had been spared by the epidemic of 1616, were crushed by a smallpox epidemic in 1633. A third to half of the remaining Indians in New England died. The people of the First Light could avoid or adapt to European technology, but not European disease. Their societies were destroyed by weapons their opponents could not control and did not even know they had. Chapter 3. In the Land of Four Quarters. Like a club right between the eyes. In the early 1960s, Henry F. Dobbins, a young anthropologist working on a rural aid project in Peru, dispatched assistants to storehouses of old records throughout the country. Dobbins himself traveled to the Central Cathedral in Lima. Entering the nave, visitors passed by a chapel on the right-hand side that contained the mummified body of Francisco Pizarro, the romantic, thuggish Spaniard who conquered Peru in the 16th century. Or rather, they passed by a chapel that was thought to contain the conqueror's mummified body. The actual remains turned up years later, stashed inside two metal boxes beneath the main altar. Dobbins was not visiting the cathedral as a sightseer. Instead, he descended into the structure's basement, cold, dank, poorly lighted, to inspect birth and death registers kept there. Dobbins belonged to a research team led by his doctoral advisor, Alan R. Holmberg of Cornell. The Holmberg after whom I have unkindly named Holmberg's mistake. Holmberg had persuaded Cornell to let him lease an old colonial estate in rural Peru. The Carnegie Corporation, a charitable foundation despite its name, provided the funds. The estate included an entire village, whose inhabitants, most of them Indian, were its sharecroppers. It was really a form of serfdom, Dobbins told me in a long conversation before his death in 2009. The villagers were just heartbreakingly poor. Holmberg planned to test strategies for raising their incomes. Because land tenure was a contentious issue in Peru, he had asked Dobbins to finalize the lease and learn more about the estate's history. With his adjutants, Dobbins visited a dozen archives, including those in the cathedral. Dobbins had been dipping his toe into archival research for more than a decade, with results he found intriguing. His first foray into the past occurred in 1953, while he was visiting his parents in Phoenix, Arizona, during a school break. A friend, Paul H. Ezell, asked him for some help with his doctoral thesis. The thesis concerned the adoption of Spanish culture by the Pima Indians, who occupy a 372,000